My goodness, everybody got on time, didn't they? Well, a number of years ago, to be exact, about the time of the dropping of an atomic bomb at Hiroshima, the age of materialism came to an end. As many persons have put all their faith in the advancements of science. And we're not intending to depreciate the good things science has done. But science as a way of life took a pretty bad beating at that time. And the conditions have continued till now. And we are all more or less living in the shadow of an unknown danger. A danger that might hit and may never hit. We hope it never will, but it has changed the entire psychology of mankind. We are no longer able to find in materialism a solution to our own personal existence. I know a number of materialists took one view on the subject, which gave them great consolation. They said they were not going to survive, but the contributions they made to human progress would survive. Those who came after them would give them a kind of vicarious immortality. They would live in their works, they would live in the contributions they had made, and they would find their own fulfillment in building this future they might never live to see. Well, it was a certain kind of solace, and a great many thinkers accepted it. But now we have another difficulty. All these people working together for a future in which their labors will be recognized and useful are faced with the dilemma of what if there isn't any future? Supposing the individuals who have given their lives to learning have created a kind of learning which is going to die and take them with them. These learnings are not very optimistic, and the materialistic scientist is no longer very popular with himself. He's not too popular with his family, and has lost a lot of his station in world thinking. In other words, materialism as a solution to the purpose of human life has been undermined and has become something that is unendurable to thoughtful and kindly persons. Now, during this period also, we have had the theological answer. The theological answer has done something to suggest a survival. But what kind of a survival? What does theology really offer? From a long time ago, religions used fear as a means of conversion. They warned human beings while they were alive that if they did not follow certain religious tenets, they will come into serious troubles after death. And out of all this came a concept of heaven and hell. Heaven for those who believed, hell for the unbeliever. A particularly good heaven for those who belong to certain groups, and rather doubtful heaven for the rest. And the general optimism of the ancient religions, which were more or less happy beliefs, was seriously damaged until very largely virtue was created or perpetuated mostly by fear, by anxiety, worry. And millions of persons went out of this life in a very unhappy state of morality. So gradually, the advancements of modern living have undermined the concept of heaven and hell as it was advanced in theological teachings. It did not seem to be particularly practical, especially if the results and rewards were to be based upon the present state of morality. There are very few good enough to go to heaven according to the old way of thinking. And we are creating more and more crime and dissipation and immorality. We are suffering from more terrorism and religious conflict than we had known for a long time before. So this concept is also not entirely a happy one. Many, many young people today growing up do not want to be good because they fear hell. And they are perfectly aware of the fact they're not likely to be good enough to go to heaven. All this is very difficult, for the death rate continues, the birth rate continues. They come and go as they always have, but their ultimate state or condition is still difficult to define. Yet without some concept of a future existence, the individual's present life becomes comparatively meaningless. In the old days, when life was rather slower and people enjoyed themselves more, physical existence was accepted as a benefit. To modern man, many human beings at least, physical existence is a penalty. The individual must wander on through high taxes and unemployment and exorbitant prices, and until at last he has to pay a reasonably exorbitant price for a funeral. This all adds up to a great deal of strange disillusionment. And we have had, in the last 10 or 15 years, a large number of younger people who have broken away from practically every institution of the past. They are disillusioned because they do not see any straight pattern of life. The rich have very little advantage because they must leave their wealth behind in due time. All of the materialistic objectives of life are short-lived. The individual building a political structure is building something that also will pass away. Almost everything we do in the material world is very transitory and fragmentary. There is very little satisfaction of soul, very little depth of insight involved in our present way of life. We are not even allowed now to go home quietly and read a good book. There is a strange fascination about television, which not only does not give us much about death, but very little about life that's worth living. So we are really in a kind of a quandary. We're going somewhere. We're all going there. But where? How? And what? Are we going to go into oblivion? A question that Socrates asked. Are we going to some mysterious realm, like the Elysian fields of the Greeks? Or are we going to the netherworld of Egypt, and at the entrance of their afterlife was a money changer ready to change the currency of this world into the currency of the next? It was a pretty thought, because the currency of the other world had to be based upon virtue rather than upon real estate. So all these things have given us pause and are giving us more pause as time goes on. In the midst of all this also, there has been a tremendous upsurge of what might be termed mystical idealism. And a few years ago, mysticism and psychic phenomena and metaphysics were kind of unhappy words. People who used them too often were considered somewhat eccentric. Today, these are the popular words. And everywhere, individuals, groups are springing up to study the psychic life of the individual. The literature on the subject is becoming massive. Everywhere, everyone is beginning to think in terms of out of this life meaning that goes into other spheres. And we are beginning to see much of the old thinking that engrossed people like Paracelsus, and even earlier, Plotinus, Pythagoras, and all these, they had certain thoughts. For a long time, material science said they were very foolish,
and put them into the background, and their books and writings were available only in pulp editions. Now, all of these things are coming back. Every folder we get from publishers today, it will include a number of ancient texts or early texts that had no market 20 years ago, but are now sought desperately by a new generation of truth seekers. And so the whole surface of our materialism has more or less broken down. It was inevitable because there was nothing there in the first place. It was held up by sophistication, anticipation, and extravagance. And these are not very helpful as we approach transition into another life. So the transition problem being inevitable and being universal, we have to begin to think more about it. And we do not like the idea of ending in nothing. And we're not too pleasantly looking forward to the various decisions of the theological purgatories. So we begin to think of the only other alternative, and that is the doctrine of rebirth. Today, according to a publication I saw somewhere, I can't quote it, but it's in substance, nearly 10% of the people of this country now believe in reincarnation. That's probably more than that, because, of course, there is no way in which they're all going to stand up and be numbered. But the belief in rebirth is spreading very broadly through the world at the present time. It used to be but largely limited to the Eastern Hemisphere, where it had a considerable following. We may say, for instance, that even today, or maybe 100 years ago, there were at least 1 billion reincarnationists in Asia. But this is more or less been left vacant as far as the Western world is concerned. A few progressive thinkers and idealists played with the idea, and some mystical organizations stood firmly behind it and insisted that it was true. But at the same time, there was not very much popular interest. But now the popular interest is increasing. Not only the interest in reincarnation, but an interest in practically every mystical or metaphysical belief of the ages. We are digging back into the past to find something to live with now. We are not pleased with the prospects as they appear, and we are not producing out of any of our learned institutions the type of idealism which is satisfying to weary, world-worn human souls. The intellectuals, the academics still insist on clinging to their own way, but they are getting fewer followers every day. We just cannot live much longer with nothing to look forward to, or something to look forward to that looks more dangerous than being here. This is not the type of situation that will bring any real comfort or consolation. Now, we have to face these problems with a certain amount of internal intelligence. Most of the matters that relate to invisible concerns, and most visible concerns emerge from the invisible. Most of these invisibles are not to be handled within the scope of modern scientific progress. We cannot physically produce the evidence that might be required. We can't build a computer as yet that will do the job successfully. We cannot demonstrate scientifically a mystical universe, but we can internally experience the need for it. And we also have the consolation of realizing that while we cannot prove it physically, academically, the academical people can't prove their materialism any better. In both cases, it's an assumption. And the difference is that the materialist feels he has the advantage because certain material objects he can see and touch. But as these retire into his inner life, they become invisible, just as in every other case. So today, we are living in a world in which the belief in physical things is weakening, and the belief that there is something behind physical life more important is gaining strength. We also are falling into a whole group of social problems that are becoming an unbearable nuisance. These problems are involved in home life, in the rearing of children, in employment, health, all the different phases of life. And it becomes increasingly obvious that without some kind of a moral structure, we are not going to be able to handle crime. We are not going to be able to bring up children as useful citizens or preserve the idealistic values of art and music and literature. We are not able to do any of these things unless there is some internal strength within ourselves. Not long ago, several great paintings came up for auction. Some of them were great classical works that have stood the test of ages. Some of them I would regard as rather poor. The rather poor ones brought the larger price at this particular auction. And pieces of so-called art, alleged art, with no significance of any kind, bring millions of dollars from people who have millions of dollars and very little taste. This situation goes on, and we see it coming back at us in every direction. In fact, it is becoming evident that the world is passing into a cycle of bad taste. It is becoming into a cycle of disillusionments, of debasements of value, and of the gradual determination to avoid all moral responsibility. The individual must now live in his own joy, and he's very unhappy over it. The joy isn't doing anything. We feel, many people feel, that the individual has a right to live the way he thinks he should. Well, this would be better if he did little thinking, but that isn't part of it. The main answer to this pattern is that the individual wishes to remove all restraints upon personal conduct. He wants to do as he pleases, live as he pleases, think as he pleases, but he doesn't die as he pleases. He gets that as a bonus. And at the end, the narcotic habit gets him, or one of the other things go bad, and we have this individual drifting out of existence with very little to recommend either his conduct or his concepts of life. Now, all this is hitting people who are basically pretty fair thinkers, and they're not very happy about it. And in this interval, we find the solution that has been advanced by the ages as a true answer to a problem that has to be faced in some way, that reincarnation is probably the best answer that man has ever devised. Now, we can say that man has devised it. Of course, it is not only sanctified by veneration, but it appears in the scriptural writings and teachings of most nations. It is a very definite part of human knowledge, human conviction, human belief, and human hope. Therefore, today, we are turning in this direction, realizing that we actually are creatures in midstream. We are not good enough for a heaven worth being in. We are not bad enough to be retailed into some mysterious inferno. We are here to grow. We are here to improve. We are here to build better lives for ourselves and each other. There is a purpose of some kind, although a large number of persons have never discovered that. They're not sure, but they are sure that they're here. And they are sure that they're living in a very wonderful world, in spite of the efforts of the human being to deteriorate it and destroy it. We are here in the presence of a great universal plan that extends beyond the horizons, into the abstractions of space. We are here with all kinds of hopes and fears and ideals and convictions, and it is very necessary for us to make the most of these convictions. Thank you very much. We are here to do something to grow the world we want to live in. Now, we are testing out all kinds of solutions. We are hoping, some are hoping, that by superior armament we're going to make it. The trouble is, this is competitive, and nearly any form of armament that we can conceive can be also used against us. So the solution of war to any human problem is merely a negative evasion of responsibility. There is no hope of solution in such an attitude. Therefore, we begin to phase out the economic system. We're going to have to take greater care of the underprivileged. We're going to have to do more things to distribute and diversify the assets of the world. We look a little careful at this particular point of view, and we discover a world of shrinking resources. We are cutting down the timber, draining off the earth, and destroying most of the inhabitants of the world in which we live, both human and otherwise. We are struggling against resources which we have wasted and are continuing to waste because of lack of any moral or ethical conviction. And even many religions make no point of this. They make no point of wasting natural resources. Some realize it, but all private citizens experience it. We experience the need for economy. We experience the need for getting together, living together, and having a purposeful existence. And we come to another final conclusion, namely, that type of an existence might be the key to our after-death state. Reincarnation is based upon the fact that we are growing creatures in an evolving structure. We are living out day by day the plan of nature. And we are also facing, as Socrates also pointed out, we are facing the payment of sin every day. Now, sin does not mean evil. The word itself means shortcoming. And therefore, a sin of omission is the type which we mostly suffer from. We do not do that which is best or necessary, and by second best and third best selections, we fall into trouble and error and discomfort. Actually, according to the Oriental philosophers, who seem to be pretty good on this thought, we are here to grow, to fulfill, to perfect not only ourselves but our world, and produce a safe environment for each other that can endure as long as the mysteries of growth remain incomplete. We should be able to look forward to thousands of years of peace, thousands of years of growing integrities, in which we daily outgrow some small part of our smallness and emerge into some small part of our largeness that lies beyond. We are here for a purpose. We are here to get over our own mistakes. We are here to find that sin does not pay, also that crime is expensive. We are here to do things right. And it is obvious that we're not quite ready to make this jump into security which the world needs. But it's coming. And even today we notice in society a marked determination to put values into better relationships. We are beginning to recognize the importance of building friendship, comradeship, cooperation, and common affection for each other. We are moving gradually from a very competitive way of life, which is gradually destroying not only ourselves but the planet on which we live, and a cooperative way of life in which man and nature in cooperation can conserve resources, fulfill the needs of existence, and build a credit system for good deeds well done. This is all part of the problem that we face. And in order to have time enough to do some of these things, we have to struggle with the one life concept of existence. One life is a very short time in the great cycle of things. One life in each individual case is variously conditioned. The average person is not born into a completely fortunate environment. He may be rather well situated, but he may also be physically infirm. He may be in an environment in which there is little opportunity for growth. We cannot say for certain that each individual can be legislated into a state of grace. It's just not possible. But we are all here to grow. And in order to grow, each individual must gradually become a little better than his own past. He must gradually develop in himself those values which in the end will protect his place in space just as much as his present local environment. So we begin to think in terms of reincarnation as a simple way of preserving natural honesty. In other words, if we live in an honest universe, and practically every philosophy and religion of importance in the world believes this, then we have to be honest ourselves. And we have to face the consequences of action. In the smaller way of life that we call a personal embodiment, from the cradle to the grave, we are constantly in the face of debt. We are constantly doing things for which there must be some type of a penalty. We are thoughtless, we are unkind, we are cruel, we are dishonorable, and the result is that there is a reaction that is not pleasant. Now, we always seem to blame this reaction upon someone else. We don't like to assume the fact that we have a system built into our own natures by which compensation is appropriate to the needs of occasion. We do not realize that we cannot be destroyed by someone else. We cannot be saved by someone else. The whole process of growth rests upon the development of the integrities by means of which we protect our own individual existence. This way of growth is not a difficult thing. It is apparently difficult when the individuals involved are isolated in the midst of a highly competitive system. But in fact and truth, cooperation is a comparatively simple thing. It is simply the individual doing what he probably instinctively would do if penalties did not prevent. We do not want war. We do not want crime or poverty. But we do not individually know how to control the processes by which these things are created or caused. They all start in ourselves somewhere. The entire system of human regeneration is locked within each individual himself. He is the cause of his own evil and the cause of his own good. He is the cause of his own difficulties, and he must be the cause of their solution. And he can be, because within himself is an equipment capable of meeting every emergency of human life. But this equipment has to be used properly. It has to be dedicated to some cause that is important enough to require a great deal of personal attention. Now, all physical causes and all physical consequences are very ethereal and ephemeral. The individual trying to solve all things in terms of his own physical existence is wrong to start with. There is no way in which the individual can cure his internal ills by merely changing his environment. Lots of people would like to wish it. But if a person with a poor nature enters a good environment, he will not improve, but the environment will be damaged. Each person must solve his own problem. And in solving his own problem, pay his own bills, take care of his own future, plan an intelligent way of existence for himself and those dependent upon him, and do all that he possibly can to increase the internal stability of the society to which he belongs. Therefore, reincarnation becomes a means of facing into yourself. It is the beginning of spiritual, moral, and ethical honesty. It is a final proof that you cannot be saved by somebody else, that you cannot be perfected without growing yourself, and you cannot be better than you are unless you make yourself better than you are. Now, the little difficulty that seems to be showing up at the moment is that while most people are becoming interested in this, there is a kind of weakness involved in the present program. The individual wants to grow, and he devotes certain time, effort, and even resources to growth, but he does not particularly seem to want to change or correct his own mistakes. He is trying to grow on a religious, philosophical, or intellectual level without involving ethical reform. He wants to be selfish and saved. He wants to keep everything he has and be virtuous as a philanthropist. He wishes to have a perfectly happy home in which other people are all right because they agree with him. He wants to be in the church that is successful and has a nice large congregation, but he does not expect to get over selfishness. He does not expect to change in his business life policies which are corrupt or dangerous to integrity. The individual wants to get better without losing any of the advantages of a bad life. He wants to keep on disliking the people he dislikes and voting in the politicians who do the most for him and all these kind of things. He also is also watching constantly for a bargain, regardless of who is damaged. So these problems do not seem to change, in spite of the fact that there is a strong idealism coming out of the problems of the day. These people are trying to do all kinds of things that are better. But against the things that are the better are the constant overwhelming presence of vanity, selfishness, and ambition. The individual is not really making the basic changes in his own life. And as a result of that, the legislations we hope for are not successful. The reforms we try to vote in, even if they are voted in, do not make much of an impression upon the vices for which they were intended to be the corrections. Now, this brings us right back now to the ethical system of reincarnation. It is one of the greatest legalistic solutions the world has ever had to its problems. It simply states very clearly that what you sow, so shall ye reap. Or as Buddha put it, the ox and the cart. The ox leads and the cart follows. And wherever the ox leads as a cause, the wagon is behind. There's an effect that must be faced. Therefore, our whole problem of a new morality, a new ethics, a new integrity, is important to our personal happiness and security. The individual who does it right will have the security in this world and will look to the future with a good hope. The laws of cause and effect tell us that every cause has to have an effect. If we set the cause in motion, we have to endure the effect. Now, there are lots of causes we can set in motion which we will not live to cure. We will make decisions on our deathbed which will require almost immediate revision. We can do all kinds of things to get ourselves in as fortunate a position as possible, but the individual has to realize that we have an account in the bank of the infinite, and most people are a bit overdrawn on this account. To meet this difficulty, the individual has to assume responsibility. If we are selfish, there isn't a religion in the philosophy or an ethics or a science in the world that can cure selfishness. We can only cure it ourselves. We may be forced to be unselfish by circumstances, but if so, the moment the circumstances change, the selfishness comes back. We have to correct these things, not because of laws, litigations, or mass movements of society, but in ourselves, if we expect to grow. Now, there are many groups of mystically minded people coming into popular eyes this particular time in our history. And most of these people want to be helpful, useful, and constructive. And also, they wish to be part of a new way of life for us all, a way of life that must come, a new age that is on the way, a threshold at the moment, because of the fact that that which has gone before will not endure, and we know it. But the question is, in most cases, to stay as we are until we are on the very brink. And when we are tottering half over the edge, then we will begin to think in terms of repentance. But it won't work that way. The time we have to start to grow is the moment we realize we need to. And we need to grow the moment we realize the troubles we're in. Wherever there are broken homes and all kinds of neglected children, overdrawn expense accounts, all kinds of secret processes going on that are not right, all these things are deadly enemies of the security we seek. And we have to start by realizing that all the changes must begin with ourselves. Now, when we start working with ourselves, we need a good motive. That's been one of the great problems, because it's going to be a long time before complete selflessness can be expected. Up to then, we are going to have a sort of divided allegiance, a little in favor of ourselves, but also something in favor of the larger and more important cause. So we have to begin, the moment we believe in idealism, the moment we believe in honesty, the moment we want to see a better world, we immediately become responsible for participating in this progress. We must do it ourselves. We do not do it by simply physically supporting organizations, but and then the organization cannot serve us if it is only supported and not actually emulated in its principles. So here we are, at various stages of age in this world, with a great sense of responsibility. The human being inside himself, if you go far enough into him, we find great truths lurking there. The individual, regardless of his affirmations of materialism or idealism or anything else, the average individual does not believe in death. He does not believe in dissolution. He does not believe in eternal damnation. He does not believe that he can evade all the responsibilities of his own conduct. The truths of the matter are inside of us, and we know it. But these truths interfere with certain selfish projects of the moment, and these gain acceptance, and the truths remain quiet or quiescent. We don't do much about them. But we're coming now to the point where everyone is asking, how are we going to handle this situation? Nature and the universe has given us the way to handle it. And in fact, it is handling it for us, whether we like it or not. The universe is determined we're going to make the grade. We are going to succeed, even though we object to the bitter end. We're going to be happy sometime if we have to feel to be miserable to do it. Actually, the laws of nature are long range, and the law of cause and effect is an infinite law. It is everywhere, in space and in the human heart. The law of cause and effect is inevitable. The law of karma, consequence, is the law of cause and effect applied to the life of individuals. Karma means, as ye sow, so shall ye reap. And that which we do shall come back to us. And there is no possible way of avoiding the results of our own actions. They can escape them for a moment, but those things which have been done in secret are known to the one person that is important, our own inner self. There is no escaping it. Karma must operate. There must be retribution and reward. Now, we think usually of karma as a very painful procedure, but this is not true. The law of cause and effect does not mean that we were just simply born to suffer. The law of cause and effect tells us that if we sow the seeds of happiness, we will be happy. As it was in the Arabian fable, happiness must be earned. That which deserves happiness will be happy. and the individual who develops the integrities with himself will benefit by his own integrities. He will also become a better citizen of the community. And if enough people agree on the level of the integrity of conduct, social problems will also fade away, because they're all based upon compromises and indifferences and a kind of spiritual ignorance which does not recognize the truth of human purpose. So we have the law of cause and effect, we have the law of karma, which operates that way, and we have the law of rebirth. We call it a law because to most people it is a law. It was so known to the Greeks and the Egyptians and the Persians and the Hindus and the Chinese. It is a part of existence, that the thing which exists does not cease to exist. There may be change, and there will be change, but every creature that exists, every form of life, has somewhere within itself a seed of immortality. It will pass through infinite changes, appear and disappear, come forth and fade, but it will never die. Therefore, all living things are part of a living universe, and the living universe cannot tolerate death in any part of itself any more than the human being, the body of man, can endure a local death without the whole body becoming involved. So the law of rebirth is something that tells us that we are constantly changing, but always growing. Now, some people are feeling of abuse. They feel that they are being shortchanged all the way along. Some people realize that they come into this life much better privileged than others. And in all things, we wonder why the inequalities of life. If we want to see the inequalities of our environment, look into ourselves, the inequalities of a family. A family is made up of individuals, each of whom has a temperament or disposition of its own. Some members of the family will work beautifully together to protect the family. Others will walk away and leave the responsibility and go off in an isolated way of their own. And if the family breaks up, the sorrow is distributed through all. Now, in reincarnation, we have the same kind of a situation. We have a level of concept, of conduct, which, if we can live it, will prevent the development of further karmic responsibilities. If we sow good seed, we will give a good harvest. If we keep on sowing selfishness, we will be selfish and the victims of selfishness. It all consists in putting our own lives into a straight constructive pattern.